Hello, welcome to The Wire, where fresh coverage of independent news and current affairs from right around Australia comes to you on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
So these rocks, why they're so interesting is because most really well-preserved fossil deposits come from rocks that are composed of sediments such as sandstone or shales.
Even though the Bathurst 1000 is now over for another year, there's still excitement in Bathurst as there has been a new discovery of unusual red rocks, which will lead the way to new fossil discoveries. Stay tuned for this and more coming up here on The Wire. But first, a change of mind due to genuine feedback and six calls to former Prime Minister Paul Keating were given as reasons for the backflip on superannuation announced by Treasurer Jim Chalmers. The plan to tax unrealised gains meant that people may have had to stump up cash for tax according to paper values rather than actual cash, which could cause issues for those that have assets that could not easily be converted to cash to pay the tax. I asked Deputy Liberal Leader and Shadow Treasurer Ted O'Brien what he thought had prompted the change in policy.
I think there's no doubt that the Prime Minister had to intervene. The Treasurer has spent a good 2 years trying to defend the indefensible. It was a fundamentally unfair policy, and it was receiving criticisms from all walks of life. And neither the Treasurer nor the Prime Minister were capable of answering very straight questions in the Parliament on this. Of course, Paul Keating even got involved. Ultimately, I would say the Prime Minister clearly intervened, and that led to a humiliating backflip on the part of the Treasurer.
I mean, if you're an accountant, when you're talking about what you need to put in the balance sheet, if it's an unrealised gain, it's not a gain until it actually happens. It was a bit of a difficult thing to swallow, wasn't it?
It was, to think that you were going to get away with taxing Australians for, effectively, it was theoretical profits. Profits that had not been made, profits that may never be made. They were going to be taxed for them. It was clearly a breach of our tax law. It crossed a red line, and it would have opened up, it would have set a precedent for the same very bad principle to be applied to different assets, not just super balances. And so this was the real concern that we had. It was very poor public policy in the first place, but it would have led to a very slippery slope for a government which is spending too much. I mean, you know, this is the highest spending government since Whitlam outside of recession, and they've got no fiscal rules containing that spending. So they're going after higher taxes, and they're slugging more debt on the national credit card. And so we know they are hungry for money to feed that addiction to spending. And I think what Jim Chalmers had put up was just an indication of how desperate they are to get their hands on money. And in that case, it was the retirement savings of hardworking Australians.
But it does seem that a lot of the hardworking Australians have done pretty well, and if they've got over $10 million in their super fund, you know, maybe they should be making a bit more of a contribution to the debt that we find that we're in.
Well, you might be talking about his new super tax. Is that right? I mean, certainly.
Yep, the $10 million seems to be the other threshold, isn't it? The 40%.
Well, so to be clear, this is. He had to come out and he had to dump his sort of super tax 1.0. And in doing so, he announced his super tax 2.0. Candidly, I think that was more an indication of not tax reform but damage control, because he immediately was incapable of answering the most basic questions about that new tax plan.
And will the Coalition be supporting these changes when that goes through to the Senate? I understand that the Greens have some concerns.
Well, because we haven't seen any detail, you just can't preempt where we might go, is the truth of it. When you have somebody like Anthony Albanese and Jim Chalmers, whose natural instinct is to go after higher taxes and higher debt, that they want to work very closely with the Greens and they don't reach out to the coalition, well, that says it all, right?
And the problems that we have in raising revenue, what do you think's the best option if, you know, you were in government?
Well, I think the two priorities that I would point to is, one, the government needs to stop its spending spree, and two, it needs to grow the economic pie. So on the spending spree, the things I'd be recommending the government does today, and this gives you a hint for where I believe the coalition should be going. Firstly, it should be introducing fiscal rules, so quantifiable rules that contains its spending. Ever since Peter Costello was treasurer, there was a charter of budget honesty. Every treasurer of the land has had rules that contains its spending, whether that be, you know, tax to GDP, these sorts of things, right? Except Jim Chalmers. There are no rules, which is why he is now taxing and he is spending like we have never seen before. So debt will hit $1.2 trillion under his own plan by the time of the next election. He is planning another decade of deficits.
Deputy Liberal Leader and Shadow Treasurer Ted O'Brien speaking with me there.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
As the deadline looms for the ban of under-16s on social media, teenagers have been sharing advice and methods online on how to circumvent the ban when it comes into effect on December 10. Recently, videos have emerged on TikTok of teenagers suggesting using a parent's email for a login or claiming that their account is managed by mum to avoid losing their accounts. Maeve Groom asked Professor Michael Dezioani from the School of Communications at the Queensland University of Technology why young people are so quick to find loopholes in the impending ban.
I think it's inevitable that when you put a barrier in front of young people in relation to the digital world, they will want to overcome that barrier. So young people want to be on social media. They get a lot of pleasure from being on social media. They get to hang out with their friends and share ideas and learn from each other. And so it's just kind of natural that they will want to continue to do that. And if someone sort of puts up a barrier to that, it becomes a bit of a challenge in a way to overcome that barrier.
There's recently been a flurry of videos on TikTok of some teenagers sharing advice on how to get around the ban. Some of these include using a parent's email for the login, claiming that the account is managed by mum, and using a parent's or someone older than them's profile picture. What does this tell us about the digital literacy of young people and the way they understand social media?
Yeah, I mean, I think that young people often have very good digital skills and they come up with clever ways to get around things that might be trying to block them. They might not always be doing things that we would want them to do. So obviously, if you have young people who are using their parents' details without their permission, then I guess that's a problem and something that we should discourage, really. But having said that, you know, young people are pretty savvy about digital technologies. They do have the skills. They have a lot of knowledge about the digital world. And they've also learnt to share those ideas with each other on the digital platform. So if one young person works out how to do something, then they're easily able to share that with their friends and, you know, then kind of spread those hacks, I suppose.
How realistic is it that enforcing a social media ban for under 16s will actually work? Is this the classic case of the more you tell a teenager they can't do something, the more they will find ways to do it?
Yeah, I do think that's right. I think even if they are successfully kind of taken off the main social media platforms, if that ends up being possible. And, you know, there's no guarantee that it will be possible. But if it is possible, young people will just find other spaces to go to. They will inevitably find other messaging services or other social media platforms where they can hang out with their friends. And it's likely also that people will produce new kinds of platforms as alternative spaces and promote those as places where young people can go where they're not going to be impacted by the ban. So I don't think there's any way in which this ban will actually stop young people from being online or being part of digital culture. And in that sense, it kind of it will be a failure in terms of meeting the objectives that it's setting out to achieve.
Major platforms, including Meta, which obviously owns Instagram and Facebook, have already started to restrict content accessible to teenagers while bringing in stricter parental controls. The Australian government expects that this would include measures for identifying teenagers trying to bypass the ban. Do you think the platforms being directly involved will make any difference?
I mean, I think the platforms are probably starting to do anything they can to show that they're trying to be responsible and that they are doing what they can to manage the users on their platforms. I mean, I don't think, you know, with them just restricting particular content for a certain age of user right now, I don't think that that is going to stop the government from including them in the ban necessarily, although it's possible that Meta will turn around and argue that because they've brought these elements into their system that they're no longer covered by the ban possibly. Maybe that's what they're trying to do. It's a little bit unclear, though, if that would work as a strategy.
Professor Michael Desuani from the School of Communications at the Queensland University of Technology and Chief Investigator for ARC Centre of Excellence for the Digital Child, speaking there with Maeve Groom. At a place called McGrath's Flat, paleontologists and geologists from the Australian Museum Research Institute have discovered fossils that are so well preserved, they're changing what we thought we knew about how fossils form. These fossils were found in red rocks, and they show tiny details that are rarely seen, such as soft tissues and even cells. Thomas Kutis asked Tara Jokic, Scientific Officer in the Paleontology Collection at the Australian Museum Research Institute, to walk us through on what makes these red rocks in Australia so special. Why are scientists saying that they're rewriting the rules on fossil sites?
Well, most exceptionally well-preserved fossil sites, so these are effectively sites that either preserve an abundance of an ecosystem or exceptionally well-preserved detail, so soft tissue information. Normally what's preserved in the rock record is hard parts because they are more resistant to decay. But in this case, these well-preserved deposits are really a window in time that give a glimpse of organisms that we don't normally see. And so these rocks, why they're so interesting is because most really well-preserved fossil deposits come from rocks that are composed of sediments such as sandstone or shale, so effectively muds or quartz sandstone, so, you know, little grains that you see on the beach. When they turn into rock, they turn into sandstone, and they're very fine grains. So muds, sands, very fine grains, and they do a really good job of preserving organisms in the rock record.
I understand that these soft tissues in fossils are super rare. How did scientists manage to find such a detailed one?
I mean, it's actually a really good question. How do fossil deposits actually get found? And often it's very fortuitous. So the story of McGrath's Flat is that it's actually nearby another really famous deposit called the Jurassic Talbragga fish beds. And they've been studied for a couple hundred years. In fact, they were studied by the original director of the Australian Museum back in the 1800s. So they've been collected for a very long time. And so scientists in the sort of 2017-18 were still studying these fish beds. And as they were going over the hill to the fish beds, one of the group of scientists picked up a rock on the ground, a red rock, and turned it over. And lo and behold, there was a effectively an insect fossil on the other side of the rock.
And what year was that? What year was that they found that?
That was about, don't quote me on this, I think that was about 2016 or 17.
Wow, okay, wow, yeah. Wow. Yeah.
So this is. I mean, can you imagine, you've got a deposit that's been studied for hundreds of years and just over the hill they find a new deposit. So, it says something about scientific discovery that you can literally be walking over a new discovery for a long time before it actually gets, found out.
We usually think of amazing fossils coming from places like ancient sites like lakes, oceans, or areas with rocks. How is this site different, and why is that site a completely surprising one?
That's a really good question. I mean, just for context, most fossils in the fossil record come from marine deposits, so things that form in the ocean. And that's simply because in the ocean you get a lot of sediment deposition. So a lot of grains of sand and mud get deposited and cover whatever has died very quickly. And they get preserved more so than things that die on land. Because on land you're not actually getting sediment deposition, you're getting weathering. And so how things form really in land-based environments is usually in things like lakes and rivers, where there is a bit of water and there is a bit of sediment deposition. Alternatively, you might have a volcanic eruption that will rapidly bury things in ash. So a good example of that is Pompeii, where the whole city was covered rapidly, right, in this ash.
Destroyed the whole city. Yes.
Yeah, destroyed the whole city, but it captured that sort of glimpse in time of the culture that was happening there that would not normally be captured to such detail. And that's because of the rapid burial that's going on in that environment. And that's very rare to happen on land.
So do you think that this discovery could change how fossils are being searched? Like, might they start exploring places that have been overlooked for so many years?
Absolutely. I mean, in the rock record, there is definitely other iron-rich tapping units that cover the landscape where we find leaves and debris. The level of preservation is nowhere near as comparable to what is found in McGrath's Flat. However, some of these other iron-rich, we refer to as sort of weathering profiles. They're kind of the, remnant weathering product of the landscape. A lot of iron is the fourth most abundant element in the crust. There's a lot of iron on the surface, and when that gets liberated and redistributed, it can actually form these beautifully iron-rich weathering profiles. And sometimes you do get leaves and things trapped within that iron, and microfossils, so like little bacteria, also get trapped in these weathering profiles. However, in McGrath's Flat, you've got an entire ecosystem that's being trapped. So the idea is that McGrath's Flat represents not just some of these potentially weathering profiles where you're getting a little bit of leaves or maybe microbes trapped, but perhaps there are parts of these hydrological landscapes, so rivers that were occurring millions of years ago, that in some places they may not be very well preserved and you might get some leaves, but in other places there might be lakes where you're getting an entire ecosystem trapped.
Tara Jokic, Scientific Officer in the Paleontology Collection, the Australian Museum Research Institute, speaking there with Thomas Kutas.
Hi, I'm Ray Martin. You're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio right across Australia. Stay well.
There is no doubt that the use of artificial intelligence has become a prominent aspect in global business operations in the past decade. However, there is a concern for those about to finish and recently finished their university degrees with how they're going to enter an AI-centric workforce. It's a question of whether or not they have the skills that are not only irreplaceable by AI, but also the skills to work alongside it. James Bale asked Associate Professor Sarah Bankins of the Department of Management at Macquarie University what are some of the ways that companies are currently utilising AI.
To help us create material, whether it might be presentations or help us to construct short form text or longer form text, help us to come up with ideas, help us to sense check ideas that we have. It's also useful getting huge amounts of data, so finding patterns, in the data, for example, helping us to find themes or draw insights. The sectors that it's being used in, AI technologies are being used in, are also really wide. So from healthcare, helping with diagnoses of patient issues, through to education, through to finance, banking, just a whole range of sectors can be using these technologies. They're exciting to understand and talk about, but we also need to be really mindful of the risks that can come with that when we're deploying them at scale, and so the things we need to think about to make sure that we're using them well.
Hypothetically, what are some of the ways that a company would regulate its AI usage to ensure that their human employees are of the top priority?
If we think about the country level, so different countries take different approaches to how they might formally regulate the use of AI. So one example of part of the world that's a bit more assertive on this front is in Europe. So Europe has an AI Act which sets out with some degree of detail how organisations should be engaging with their use of AI, particularly in what we might call high-risk use cases. So, for example, where AI is being used, where it might have an impact on people's lives or livelihoods. But organisationally, so for example, in this country, we have the federal government has AI ethics guidelines, which can help organisations with that kind of question, like how can we ethically and how can we appropriately use these technologies alongside our workers? And so I think one of the things that organisations can do on that front is actually to think about and put at the forefront of their thinking, how will our use of AI, how is that going to impact our people and what they're going to do? Generally, any kind of technology, whether it's AI or other types, it can impact work in a few ways. It can replace certain things that humans might have done. So it can replace often its tasks, not necessarily whole jobs. It can complement us, so it can help us to do things better. It can help us to do our jobs better, get new insights. It can help to do really routine, boring stuff. It can do that kind of work. And it can also help us to create new forms of work and maybe sometimes even new occupations and wholly new jobs. If their focus is on cost reduction, and it means they might have an automation focus, which is about replacement predominantly, that can often lead to not great outcomes for their workers because it might mean some are displaced. It might mean some lose parts of their jobs that are really interesting and important and meaningful to them. If an organization says, actually, our focus in using any kind of technology is we want it to help our people, we want it to make their experiences of work better, then that's more that complementarity, new task generation pathways.
One of the common uses of AI is in the hiring and recruitment sector for whatever company it is. What are some of the downsides or problematic issues that would arise from using AI?
In sort of recent years, we've seen some high-profile cases of organisations using AI in the recruitment part, so where they might be scanning through CVs to shortlist candidates. And one of the things with these technologies is they're only kind of as good as the data that underpins them and how they're built. The data has not been great. So the data has been biased in some way. So some of these high-profile cases were where there were discriminatory outcomes based on gender. If you think about recruitment, it's often a high-touch, high-human contact process. People aren't given the opportunity to engage with a human, with a person, as they're going through recruitment. And it can lead to those feelings of being dehumanized. It also means that people can not get a great sense of what it might be like to work in an organisation.
In school and university, the usage of ChatGPT to write essays and do other assignments is currently banned. Should there be a different approach? Should schools and universities adapt their curriculum to adjust to an AI-centric workplace?
I think when technologies like ChatGPT first came out, we did see some examples of knee-jerk reactions, right, of, wow, this is a really powerful tool. You know, what does this actually mean for education and students' learning? I think there's increasingly using these technologies more, and they're just more and more accessible. We've had to ask ourselves, educational institutions and educators have had to ask ourselves the question, okay, we realistically can't stop people from utilising it. So I think we're moving now towards how do we, as you say, how do we integrate this into our learning for students in ways that are helping students understand how to use it appropriately and critically and ethically while still supporting their learnings. And we are seeing some educational institutions start to move that way, sort of having, for example, some assessments pieces where AI is okay to use it, but use it in a guided way. So knowing where it's important to still activate our human judgment alongside using these kinds of AI tools in some way.
Associate Professor Sarah Bankins from Macquarie University speaking there with James Bale. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.